It's 8 o'clock. This is KVNF Regional News for Friday, August 28th. I'm Patricia Naft. A substantial amount of money from the federal government will go towards trying to save the sage-grouse. The news comes about 1 month before a major deadline for the bird. KVNF's Jake Ryan has more.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture just announced $211 million that will go towards protecting the sage-grouse in the West. The plan, called the Sage-Grouse Initiative 2.0, provides money for ranchers and landowners to make conservation improvements to their property. It's part of a long effort to protect the bird and help it rebound, and for many, help it avoid a listing as an endangered species. That decision, whether or not it will be labeled as endangered, will be made this September 30th. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services has been considering the bird for years, but a lawsuit brought by the Wild Earth Guardians last year gave them the hard deadline at the end of September. Eric Mulvar is a biologist with Wild Earth Guardians. He's happy with the money that the USDA is putting forward to help the bird, but warns that by itself, it's not enough.
To the extent that folks are looking at these monetary programs as a replacement for either strong federal sage-grouse protections in plans or endangered species listing, I think they're fooling themselves, because if you have human activities that are causing the sage-grouse declines, and you allow those human activities to continue to harm the sage-grouse habitat, the declines are going to continue irrespective of how much money you might throw at them.
Mulvar, and a lot of other people, have their eyes set on September 30th to see what the decision will be. That may not be the final date, though.
It is possible that any decision the Fish and Wildlife Service might make could be challenged on the basis of its legality or the scientific facts behind it.
The big decision may not be made by the Fish and Wildlife Service, but in a courtroom. For KVNF, I'm Jake Ryan.
Issues continue with 38 Road outside of Palisade. Earlier this week, crews began fixing a retaining wall along the first half mile of the road. Now, a pipe that runs through the wall and provides irrigation water to thousands of farmers and residents in the area is shut off. Orchard Mesa Irrigation District officials told the county they hope to have the water back online today or Saturday. The Daily Sentinel reports the canal serves about half of the district's 9,500 customers. A group of Delta County stakeholders want to breathe new life into a shuttered agricultural research center. KVNF's Laura Pomisano reports.
The Colorado State University facility is on 83 acres outside of Hotchkiss on Rogers Mesa. The property has a residence, classrooms, laboratory space, offices, cold storage, a greenhouse, and equipment sheds. CSU used the site to conduct research on fruit trees, but now the classrooms and laboratories sit empty. The university closed the center 4 years ago. CSU planned to sell the site, but that's when a group of Delta County stakeholders stepped in. Robbie LaValle is the county's administrator.
It was at that time when the sale was closed that state representatives and Delta County Commissioner and Delta County Economic Development thought that facility, that property, was worth another look at as an asset to the community.
The group commissioned a study to find out if the site has potential as an education center or farm incubator. The findings were published last week.
From that feasibility study, it was determined that just a straight education facility would not pay, but that a combination of commercial and education and research would pay if there was some commitment from CSU to hold the lease value at a low dollar amount.
LaValle says now the county is accepting letters of interest from organizations that want to help develop new programs at the agricultural site. The county is accepting letters through October 1st. For KVNF, I'm Laura Pomisano.
This fall, Judge Gabriel will be sworn in as Colorado's next state Supreme Court justice. He currently serves on the Colorado Court of Appeals. He received his undergrad degree from Yale University and went to University of Pennsylvania School of Law. He talked to State House reporter Benta Berkland about his view of politics in the judicial process, his career, and some of his significant cases.
Judge Gabriel, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
When the governor announced your appointment, he talked about your strengths in the business community and some of the cases you've worked on. Could you highlight some of that aspect of your background?
Sure. When I first got out of law school, I worked for a federal judge in Baltimore. Then I joined a large firm in New York where I did basic commercial and business litigation. I then joined the firm that was Holm Robertson Owen. It's now Brian Cave here, where again I did business litigation and intellectual property litigation.
Now you're serving on the Court of Appeals. What are some of the big challenges there, and what have you enjoyed about this position?
What I've most enjoyed about being on this court is the collegiality of this court. Anyone who knows anything about the law knows it's not always the case in courts where judges are collegial. We work together. We work very hard in this court. Our docket is very high. We decided as a court something on the order of 2,200 cases last year. There's not a whole lot of breaks for us as the first-level appellate court and frequently the court of last resort, seeing all manner of every kind of interesting case you can imagine.
For the listener, can you just list off a few?
Every kind of crime, with the exception of death penalty cases, which go directly to the Supreme Court, we see. The ones I remember, I suppose, are the hardest ones. I had a very difficult case involving rent controls in Aspen. It was difficult because of the procedural setting in the case. I had a case involving a young man in El Paso County who, because of his religious faith, could not have a blood transfusion, and he was diagnosed with leukemia. And the question presented was, can a mature minor make that decision to refuse life-saving treatment?
What did you guys decide?
In that case, we ultimately decided that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to decide the issue. It was a procedural thicket.
A nonpartisan judicial nominating committee comes up with three final candidates, and you were one of those three, and the governor chose you. What was that process like?
I'm a big fan of our merit selection system in Colorado. The way it works is you fill out a fairly lengthy application that goes to this nominating commission that's nonpartisan. They work exceptionally hard based on my experience. They call references. They call your opponents in cases if you're a trial lawyer. In my case, they call litigants who appeared in front of me. And the majority of the commission are non-lawyers. And I frankly find the non-lawyers' questions to sometimes be much more interesting and difficult than the lawyer questions. They ask questions about what was the biggest mistake that you've ever made and how did you deal with it. Then the governor does an extensive due diligence process, which again is fascinating to watch close at hand to see how hard they work. They solicit comments from lawyers all over the state.
You are a registered Democrat. How are you able to separate out politics from your job?
It's not an issue at all. My approach to any case is to figure out what the rule of law is or the rules of law that apply, and to try to apply those rules to the facts presented in the narrowest possible way consistent with doing justice.
Do you think that there is a change in tenor around the country when it comes to judges? I know judges are typically seen as nonpartisan and separate from politics, but then when we have the U.S. Supreme Court, and obviously some of those tough decisions are political in nature.
There are two different ways to look at that. First, in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a perception that their cases are frequently political and 5-4 decisions. Historically, that's not actually the case if you looked at their complete docket. The highly sensitive social issues tend to get a lot of the press, and those are sometimes, or maybe even frequently, 5-4 decisions. But many times the court decides unanimously. So I think there may be a misperception based on the nature of those cases. The other thing that affects politics or the view of politics in our system is the way we select judges. Colorado is a merit selection state. In other jurisdictions, they elect judges in partisan elections. I've got to be careful talking about making political statements, but that creates certain issues, like judges raising money to campaign in a partisan election where perhaps they run as a member of a certain party. As a criminal defendant, you're sitting in a courtroom where a judge has run on the grounds, I'm going to be very hard on criminal defendants, and you're a criminal defendant, that at least raises some concerns.
Thanks. That was Judge Richard Gabriel. He will become Colorado's newest Supreme Court justice.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
For KVNF News, I'm Patricia Naft.